So, as we make our way through this 49-part series of Mirtzah Shem about Torah, its evolution, its impact, its symbolisms, in the lead up to Lag BaOmer. Of course, you have to be careful on Lag BaOmer itself. I'm recording this before Lag BaOmer, not to say it's Lag BaOmer before you actually count Lag BaOmer, because you could have already counted by just saying it. So, but we are a few days before Lag BaOmer. I want to take a quick sidebar. We just finished discussing the Rambam, but we're going to discuss the Ramban. I want to discuss one or two of the grammarians, maybe the Eben Ezra, maybe Abar Benel, Parashat on Tanakh, if we have time. But get a little sense of what Kabbalah was, how it impacted us, and then the modern day expression or manifestation of Kabbalah in the world of Hasidus. So, Mirtzah Hashem, the first year, first little comment, I'll talk about Kabbalah in general, and then we'll segue to Hasidus, the 18th century or the 18th century incarnation of Kabbalah. So, Kabbalah is inaccurately described as mysticism, as Jewish mysticism. That is a misnomer. That is a word trap. It implies that Kabbalah is non-rational, that it's non-cognitive. There were trends throughout Jewish history of Kabbalah in which people engaged in non-rational Kabbalistic activity, induced hallucinatory stages, levitation, meditation, but those are very, very tangential and very peripheral. If you went back and witnessed someone studying Kabbalah, let's say in the medieval period when most of our Rishonim studied Kabbalah, the Ramban studied Kabbalah, the Rashba studied Kabbalah, Yosef Cairo studied Kabbalah, of course, Ari studied Kabbalah, the Vilna Gaon studied Kabbalah, you would not see them in a mystical state of non-rational activity. You would see them with a pen and a pencil or a paper or a quill, writing, thinking, very much resembling the way you and I would study Gemara, or for that matter, math. It was a completely rational activity. So what is a better way to describe Kabbalah, and what is Kabbalah? So let's first describe what it is, and then I'll give you a word, which I think is a much more accurate reflection. Hashem created us in our world. He didn't just create us in our world, but he constantly supports and infuses us in our world with life. Mechadesh b'chol yom tamid. How did Hashem create the world? How does Hashem support us with life? That's hard. We don't really know. And not only do we not know because the information is undiscovered, we can't know. It's hard for us to know because Hashem is so different. We can't understand him. We can't comprehend him. He's unfathomable. No human construct or human idea or human word can describe him. So go figure how an indivisible, everything we know in our world is divisible, everything can be divided into subparticles, unlimited and infinite, everything we know in our world is finite, how a non-physical, everything we know in our world is physical, how a non-physical, infinite, indivisible being can create me, our world, and not just create our world, but create a cup of water or polymer, something which is plastic or something. Well, let's talk about divinely created actions. So, there's a huge gap between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and us in our world. And that gap is best captured by the pasuk we recite on Etanis, Ki lo machshavos, ay machshavos echem, ve lo darchichem derecheinu mashem. My thoughts are different from your thoughts. My ways are different from your ways. Now, a non-Mekubal accepts that gap between himself and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Accepting that gap, accepting that difference, and submitting to Hashem as a higher authority that you can't understand, that's called Yirat Shamayim. Yirat Shamayim is not fear and trembling and fright. Yirat Shamayim means submitting to a higher authority whose mystery you can never understand. And that's where a non-Mekubal tops out. There's a gap. Hashem commands, I obey, and I focus all my attention on not why and how, but what. What does Hashem want of me? What does it mean? How could I understand the will of Hashem as incorporated in the Torah? How did he create me? I don't know. Rav Amital, my Rebbe, would always tell us. He begins reading the Torah from Parshas Lech Lecha. He doesn't understand creation, big bang, small bang. I know Hashem told Avram to move to Israel. I moved to Israel. And Mekubal says, I'm not satisfied with that gap. We have to bridge it. We have to map how an infinite, non-physical, indivisible being can create a cup of water and sustain it. So we have to map it. Here's the issue. How do you map a world? Because there are worlds occupying that gap between Hashem. And through those worlds, Hashem's infinite, non-physical, indivisible essence slowly, 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 slowly trickles down, Hishtal Shulos, through a very, very intricate network of worlds. Within each world, very intricate lattice works through which it, imagine like a little drop of water, so to speak. It's all imagery and metaphor trickling down, 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 down. Our world, as huge as it is, if you took a fusion spaceship, a fusion-powered spaceship, fusion energy, and you immediately travel to the edges of the universe, where it is right now, the universe is always expanding, but at any given moment, it's finite, you would see a door handle. And you'd open that door handle, and you'd realize that our universe, as vast as it is, as infinite as it feels, is just one small room of one world amongst many worlds that are tiered, T-I-E-R-D, one on top of each other, on their way to Hashem's infinite, non-physical, indivisible presence. Those of you who remember, old enough to remember the Truman Show, where the entire world was just a stage. Could you imagine if everything we know were just one small room of one small building tiered upon other buildings? So there's no way for us to acquire that knowledge. That's why here's the key difference. Knowledge is not empirical. Empirical means you can prove it through scientific tools, through discovery, through human intellect. There's no way to prove it because we're locked in our reality, and science and human thought can only scan and probe our reality. That's why it's Kabbalah. You have to receive the information. But once you receive the information, you process the information, and you think about the information, and you map the information in the same way that you'd map anything else through cognition and ration. It's just the starting point can't be proved. It's unprovable. So that's the better way to refer to Kabbalah. It's not mystical. It's not non-rational. It's not non-cognitive. It's just non-empirical. It's not scientific. You can't prove anything. So what would be a good word for Kabbalah? This is my preferred word. Since it talks about realities beyond our world, we usually use the term cosmos to describe everything, even beyond our world, which we call the world, the universe, the systems. So I call it cosmology. Others have called it also. We try to study the entire system of cosmology up until HaKadosh Baruch Hu created everything and sustains everything. That's a brief definition of what Kabbalah is. What's the source of Kabbalah? Well, Kabbalah, according to our Chazal, dates all the way back, even before Har Sinai. Many Rishonim attribute a Sefer called Sefer HaYetzira, maybe to Adam, maybe to Avram. This is all very, very shrouded. We don't really know. But we always were involved in studying this map and studying the ways in which Hashem created the world and Hashem sustains the world. Look at Yechezkel, Perek Aleph, and Perek Yod. Again, it's all very coded. Chazal speak about Maaseh Bereishis and Maaseh Merkava, both in the context of the Gemara and Chagiga, that you're not allowed to teach some of these issues and too many students at once because there'll be confusion and corruption. The same Gemara, or different Gemara Chagiga, talks about four who were Nechnesu Lepardes, who started to explore these areas, and not all of them emerged unscathed. Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha, not Rabbi Yishmael that we know of, a different Rabbi Yishmael, wrote a Sefer called Sefer Hechalos about the palaces, different compartments of these worlds. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai was involved. Some say he wrote the Sefer HaZohar, even though the Sefer HaZohar only appears approximately 1300s in Spain. Some say he wrote it and the Sefer only appeared later. Rav Cook was once asked, is it true that he may not have written it? He said, it doesn't make a difference. If Rav Shimon ben Yochai didn't write it, it was written by someone else of great stature and great sanctity and great vision. Shimon ben Yochai was involved in other areas of Kabbalah that weren't necessarily compiled into the Sefer HaZohar. So that question, which rears its head every Lag BaOmer, who wrote the Sefer HaZohar, is an academic question. It's obviously interesting, but so this has been studied throughout our history. It's part of our Masara. Denying it, I wouldn't say that it's Kfira, but denying it is just, it's intellectually bankrupt. It's part of our Masara. Our Chazal were involved in Kabbalah. Rava had a Sefer Yetzira. They made a golem. They studied the esoteric, is another way to phrase it. Now, how did we get to where we are right now? Well, the two great rationalizers of Jewish history were Rabbeinu Sadjagon in the 9th century and the Rambam in the 12th century. And the Rambam had a deep influence on the Ashkenazic world for sure. That's why the Sephardic world still remains a little bit more tuned to Kabbalah. But for some reason in the modern world, with the influence of the Rambam, our world has turned much more rational and empirical and concrete, and for better and for worse. And we lost some of that Kabbalah tradition. And that's why most people today focus all their energy on the world that we call Nigla, the world of empirical reality and religious texts and practices. Unless on Kabbalah, there's still some people who practice Kabbalah. And even for people who are non-Mikubala, like myself, recognizing the broader world of Kabbalah and recognizing its many, many different impacts on our lives. For example, it puts human experience into perspective. If we just occupy one small room amongst many planets or four, it's called Abia, Aleph, Beis, Yud, Ayin. Aleph is the Atzilus, the upper world closest to Hashem. Bet is Bria, Yud is Yetzira, Ayin is Asiya. So we just occupy a small lower rung on Asiya. So that influences how I think about my place in the universe, humility, cosmology, free will, metaphysics, inevitability of history, my place, especially if Kabbalah becomes bidirectional, which for many Kabbalah it is, especially if the Ariya Kodesh is Kabbalah, where it's not just that I'm affected by all the upper worlds as Hashem's essence starts to trickle down, but it's bidirectional. I can affect upper worlds as well. So in some ways, it doesn't diminish human magnitude. It amplifies human magnitude because my small actions here don't just affect my life and life of those around me, but affects even upper worlds that I'm not aware of. This is, of course, of Chaim Volozhin's theories in the Nefesh HaChayim. I don't have time to go into every detail of Kabbalah, but that's a nice, hopefully, a nice little introduction to Kabbalah. Tomorrow we'll talk about Chassidus, Mirtzah Hashem.